I'm Steve Martin. I'm your host of Unreal Bluegrass. My guest today, Greg Rich. Greg Rich is a luthier with a great history behind him. Gibson, before that, he did his own work. He worked for Gibson. He now does Recording King and does very special banjos in addition to the normal Recording King, which are fine banjos. Here's the news. Greg Rich has been inducted into the 2021 class of the American Banjo Museum in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. It's a really big deal. There are a lot of great players. There are some luthiers, which is a word you're going to hear us talk about. There are some luthiers and players of all kinds, four-string, five-string, you name it. Everything is in the American Banjo Museum. And now Greg Rich will be officially installed in 2021. He's my guest coming up right now. I'm really happy to welcome the Unreal Bluegrass. Many of you may know him. You may know of what he does and what he makes now at this point of his career. Or you may just know him from, I will say, Greg, kind of a flamboyant figure on social media. And I'm talking to Greg Rich. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. The reason that I contacted you is, number one, one of the most respected luthiers that I can name right now, recent, and further proof of that, was just elected to the American Banjo Museum Hall of Fame, which is a huge honor. I immediately think now, current days, maybe people would recognize Recording King easier, but you have a rich history, no pun intended, in with Gibson, with all kinds of instrument manufacturers, and with an affinity to the Mummers in Philadelphia, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But I need you to, first of all, back up a little bit on, I don't understand the process of wanting to become a luthier. So that's a mystery to me. So I want you to just kind of, I don't need to know when you're born. I don't want to start from that far. Let's skip the juvenile stuff and get to, you know, where, get me started and we'll flesh it out.
Okay, so a couple of things that really made me want to build. I grew up in Newport Beach, California, and it wasn't really a mecca for bluegrass at all. But I fell in love with the music. And
stop right there. Who did you first hear then? What was your first exposure to the music?
Well, when my dad took all of us kids to see the movie Bonnie and Clyde.
Me too.
I never forgot the soundtrack to that movie. It always stayed in my head. But I always wondered, what was that instrument in there? You know, what made that sound? You know?
This is crazy because, you know, I'm not dropping names here. I was just talking to John McEwen this morning, and that's absolute truth. And he's been on the show 6-8 times. And he said, what was it that brought you to bluegrass? I said, that car driving down the road in Bonnie and Clyde.
Right.
I said, exactly. I left the theater. The other guys were saying, did you see how many times they got shot? Or did you see Faye Dunaway coming down the stairs? And I kept thinking, what was that sound? I couldn't believe it.
Exactly.
That's cool. Go ahead. It's your story, but I had to tell you that's an odd coincidence. But go ahead.
So, and then, of course, on Friday nights, the family would go to Shakey's Pizza. And every once in a while, they would have the ragtime piano player and a banjo, you know, plectrum player sit in and play banjo with them.
Sure.
So I'm kind of going, oh, man, I love that sound. But I met this a man named R.C. Snoddy, Randy Snoddy, who lived about 3 miles from my house. And he really became my mentor. And as it turns out, he just not only played music, but he was a collector, one of those first collector in the first generation of horse traders, collectors of music. And I would spend every single minute at his house. If I wasn't working or in school, I was at his house playing music, you know, and he would teach me songs. And he would, every time he'd get a new banjo in, he would show it to me like, Greg, this is a TB Granada, you know, a tenor banjo Granada, and I'm going to have a five-string neck made for it. Or I've got this D45, a Lloyd Lorman. So I got to see all these incredible pre-war instruments growing up. And one day, he brought out a mint-condition Florentine Gibson tenor banjo. And I never forgot. I must have stared at that thing for, I don't know how many hours, thinking, what a piece of art that is. And I just wanted to build one. I said, Matt, I want to build one of these. And he started laughing. He goes, well, now, wait, hold on a minute. This takes years to learn how to build, you know, something like this. I said, nah, I had been involved with the Boys Club, you know, from the time I was a, you know, teenager, learning wood crafting.
Okay, that was going to be my next question, is you must have dealt with the material before, because
you don't just start out. I went to the wood shop part of the Boys Club. I didn't care about the sports. I went right for the how to learn a bandsaw or do lathe work, polishing metals. And so I kind of had a good arts and craft background. And when I saw that banjo, I was looking at it going, well, let's see, what am I going to need to do this? You know? And so there was nobody to teach me, so I kind of had to learn myself how to do this. So I first started, I took a class, a guitar building class in San Diego. It was like a 3-day class, and just kind of a very, excuse me, it was like a 3-week class.
Yeah.
Go down there and just gave you the basics on building. And when I graduated, I told Randy, I said, hey, I got to get a shop together, get some tools and learn how to build. Well, he cleared out his garage and made and let me put a shop in his garage when I just started. I thought, man, okay. And he started encouraging me to build. He said, whatever you need, Greg, we'll get the tools for you and you can, you know, build some stuff here. And one thing led to another. Like
that, first of all, in and of itself, that is amazing.
Yeah, I can't say enough about, you know, he is really responsible for me. Building instruments, just, you know, took me under his wing, taught me music, encouraged me to build anything I wanted. He would do it, you know, to help me. So, I had to start getting some parts together and learning how to metal engrave. So I found a gun engraver up in Sacramento. So I drove up to his house and I said, can you teach me, you know, how to engrave metal? And spend a day with me.
A day. Greg, and for the listeners, again, I'm talking to Greg Rich, who's a master luthier. But so the Florentine banjo that really sparked your has engraved metal. So you're looking at all the skills, learning all the skills that will help you build something like that. So then, all right, you're back in Sacramento with the gun.
So I found a gun engraver, and he said, yeah, come on up for a day, and I'll show you some basic stuff, how to sharpen tools and stuff. And I spent 2 days with him. And then I just started practicing metal engraving. And then I knew, how am I going to learn how to carve this stuff? Well, I found a wood carver in Long Beach. So I called him and I said, would you mind teaching me a few things about wood carving? So I went to her house and she would show me how to carve. You know, some basic stuff. I came home, started learning how to carve. And it was just like I would go to car shows and ask the painters, how do you paint? You know, how do you do that painting? You know, and so they would show me some things about hand painting. And then I went to Henry Lee, who was a real famous person at restoring, like, tenor and plectrum banjos. I went to his house in San Francisco with a friend, and he taught me how to paint the scenes on a fingerboard. You know? So I kind of had to seek out all these different individuals, you know, and to learn. And... Well, and Randy would sit back and kind of laugh. He'd go, Greg, are you actually going to build one of these things? And he goes, don't you want to build like an RB3 or something first or, a Walnut 4? And I said, Randy, I'm going to build that Florentine. And so I worked at it and worked at it. And
where did you get the raw materials, though? And I don't mean totally raw, but where did you get the metal and the wood to begin the carving?
For the blank stuff, of course, I didn't have all the complete tools. At that time, I was friends with Bill Sullivan at First Quality Banjo.
Sure.
And he got me the resonator and the neck blank. And he goes, Greg, I'll get it to this stage, and then you shape it in and do all your work and binding, you know. And so that's kind of how I started. And so my very first banjo was a Florentine, you know. And I'll never forget it when I took it into Randy and I put it in front of him. And he just shook his head and he goes, I just can't believe that you did that. That's your first banjo. And I said, well, what do you think? He goes, that's pretty good. You want to build a neck for this Florentine tenor now? You know? So that's kind of what inspired me.
Well, let's put brackets on this time. Then.
Okay.
You see the Florentine, blows your mind. You build a Florentine. How long between those two moments?
About a year and a half.
A year and a half.
About a
okay.
year and a half.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. You know, and in between, I learned to cut some inlays, do inlay work, do whatever I could. But for me, decorating the banjos was what I fell in love with. You know, I mean, I didn't want to build the entire neck blank or, you know, learn how to press a resonator or that stuff, because to me it was the art of decorating it to something, you know, super fancy. And so
but still with a good tone that a banjo player would want.
Well, I didn't, you know, I played banjo, but I wasn't that, I don't know how to say this, but tone at that point hadn't really entered my mind because I didn't know archtops, flatheads, no-hole flatheads, 20-hole flatheads.
Yeah.
So I was still learning that process in my playing. You know, I hadn't really tube and plate versus one-piece flange. I didn't really understand that whole flathead type sound that people liked.
Gotcha.
To me, it was just about building and decorating instruments. And so Randy, you know, he would get like a Paramount Artist Supreme, and he goes, Greg, look at this piece of bindings missing. Could you make that binding and make it match? And so I'd spend all night out there piecing together wood and putting the binding in, you know, for it, or re-engraving some pearl on a Vega, or just whatever kind of little repairs a pre-war needed to get it back to look original. And Randy would always stress on me, goes, Greg, don't make it look new. Make it look like it fit the period. You know, don't overdo your work. If you're working on Gibsons, make it like the Gibsons. So I studied so hard every Gibson banjo. I mean, I would tear them down, look at them, do rubbings on the engravings, take detailed photos of every carving so that in the future – when I had to do a repair work, I could kind of learn, this is how a Florentine gets painted. This is how I age the lacquer. This is how I, you know, so that's kind of, and kind of my reputation grew in the Southern California area for doing that kind of work, which then led me to Matthew Suda, who was the U.S. buyer for the Samora Corporation, Mr. Akira Samora. And then pretty soon, Mac was bringing me all of their banjos to do touch-up work on. So now I was, you know, working on everybody's high-end banjos, kind of. So
and at the same time, you're still logging. I think you're still logging characteristics so that you can have.
Those. Oh, I never stopped. Yeah. I got a complete pile. But I think the one thing that kind of really made me decide to start really concentrating on building is we used to have a get-together in Huntington Beach, California, and like once a month, and everybody showed up to pick, and I was kind of like a fairly good player, but nothing spectacular, you know. And this kid named Tim Weed, he was, I don't know how old he was then, but he came by and he goes, oh, you know, would you teach me some banjo lessons? You know, would you give me banjo lessons? And so he came to my house because I was, at that time, I was taking lessons from Larry McNeely up in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And so Tim comes over to my house, and I taught him a Larry McNeely tuned slip disc. And that was the last lesson I ever saw Tim. And then 6 months later, I saw Tim, and he was playing circles around everybody. I mean, everything. I remember just sitting down going, you know what? I'm going to concentrate on building.
Well, no.
I'm never going to be a player.
Well, I had that awakening also, but you could at least say I taught him. I taught him
to
play.
Yeah, no, I'm going to take credit. Yeah, and now he's taking credit for me going into the Hall of Fame. He goes, Greg, look at this.
That's
so fair. Gets credit
that's,
for me.
That's fair.
Right. So, you know, a lot of things, you know, led to that. I eventually got a job with Dobro over in Huntington Beach engraving all the metal body guitars for them.
And you're probably talking about steel body guitars also.
Yeah,
not just the square neck, but you're talking
about
the
square neck. Yeah, they have their, you know, their I don't know what their model 75
right.
and
you know, those kind of instruments. But you had the Lily of the Valley,
yeah, okay.
Chrysanthemum, you know, that kind of stuff.
Beautiful.
So then comes the Gibson. Should we talk about Gibson?
Absolutely. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So at this time, I think that was probably about 85 or 86, Gibson was developing a prototype Granada in Nashville, you know. And
Greg, when you say that in the 80s, the listeners are thinking, oh, wait a minute, the Gibson Granada existed from
yes.
Willis Prior. So something happened where there was a gap where they weren't making them anymore, and was it their intent to get back into marketing a Granada?
Right. So Gibson, Henry Jeskowitz and Dave Berryman had purchased the Gibson company, moved it to Nashville, and they had brought in some good luthiers there, Charlie Darrington, Jim Triggs, and some fantastic people to get their bluegrass thing back going again. And they had developed a reissue Gibson Granada, which, of course, was a reissue of the pre-war stuff. And they had showed that prototype around town, and it had gotten terrible reviews. People just said, no, it's not right. It's just not correct. So they were coming to the NAMM show to show it, and Jim Triggs, a good friend of mine, called me up. He goes, Greg, are you going to be at the NAMM show? Would you come over and look at this banjo for us and tell us what's wrong with it? And so I made a trip up to the Gibson booth, and Henry Jeskowitz was there with Dave Berryman, Jim Triggs, and a bunch of people, and they brought the banjo out for me to look at. And I just started pointing out everything that was wrong with it. And I said, if you put this on the market, you're not going to sell anything. It's just, it's wrong. It'll be picked apart instantly by the people that know. So Henry asked me, he goes, well, would you fly back to Nashville in next month and talk to us a little bit more? I said, yeah, no problem. So I flew back. We sat down in the office, and Henry goes, what would it take to make that banjo right? And I told him, I said, scrap everything you have here. Scrap it and start over. And he said, well, what would you have to do that? And I'd have to – and I just told him, I said, Henry, if you are asking me to run this banjo department, I want to handpick the people at Gibson, and only those people will work on banjos. Now, I want a sprayer, a neckline person, a buffer, and that kind of stuff. And they will come to a banjo division, and their only job will be banjos. And he goes, okay, it's all yours.
You
take
it.
And he was fantastic. He let me go through the plant, and I got Nick Kimmins, I got Ed Weber, Rhonda Vanetta, Sam Calvert. I got these incredible luthiers that worked at Gibson. I mean, anybody, any employee at Gibson would have qualified because they were all incredible people, you know, dedicated to instrument building. But we ended up with a group of about five or six of us, and that became the banjo division. And we reintroduced the Granada, and from there it's kind of history, you know, of what happened.
Well, and because you're not mentioning it, but all of a sudden the Gibson banjo itself had a resurgence in quality. I mean, they were always on the market, and I'm just saying this from someone on the outside looking in, that there was a point when I was learning, and maybe I'm talking mid-70s, early 80s and whatnot, when you wouldn't buy a new Gibson.
Right.
You just wouldn't. You would find other things. But so when you got involved, and I'm saying this because you may not say it, because you're a shy guy, Greg, I know how you are. But when you got involved in that department, the quality went through the roof again.
Well, we did
my,
the best we could.
My opinion. I thought they changed markedly.
But I think the night that changed it for us was Doug Hutchins had been brought on to do artist relations for Gibson. You know, Henry had hired Doug Hutchins. And I told Doug, I said, Doug, we got the Granada done. And he goes, how's it look? I said, it looks good. I think it's going to be good. So Doug Hutchins called Sonny Osborne. And Sonny said, okay, you have Greg come out to the Opry Saturday night. I want to see the banjo. And Sonny had already seen the prototype and told him to get lost. He didn't want nothing to do with it. Yeah, no, he said, I'm not, you know. So I was like so nervous because this was the first time I've ever got to meet Sonny Osborne. And at that time, Sonny had a pre-war original Granada, which he, of course, you know, put on a pedestal. So imagine trying to show him a new Granada and meeting him for the first time. So I was like so nervous. So me and Jim Triggs got to Granada. We went out to the Opry, met Sonny Osborne in the dressing room, and he got the banjo out and started looking at it. And he was asking me all the questions about it. And I remember Doug Hudson's telling me before he got great, just don't lie to Sonny.
No.
Don't do it. Just tell Sonny the truth.
Exactly.
And you'll be fine. So Sonny starts, you know, asking me all these questions about it. And I kept answering it. And he goes, what about this, that, this, this? And I said, you know, this, you know, Sonny, we're a production banjo. I understand what you're saying, but this is how it has to be for this. So Sonny's looking at it. He's kind of fiddling with it. And takes his strap off his old banjo, puts it on the new one, kind of stands up and picks it a little bit. And he's still asking me questions. And then all of a sudden you hear over the speaker, Osborne Brothers to the stage, and he's got the banjo on. Yeah, he walked onto the stage on the Saturday Night Live portion, walked out there and did a 10-minute commercial for Gibson and introduced me and Jim Triggs.
Oh, nice.
And so he goes, and this is the new banjo they're building over at Gibson. And I think from that point on, it was done. I mean,
You had instant street credibility.
I mean, when Sonny said, this is a great banjo, I kind of went, phew, man.
Because you know Greg, because you know him now, that if he felt different, he would have said exactly the opposite. He would have gone out there on stage and said, you know,
he wouldn't have even picked up the banjo.
Well, he might have taken it out to say that it wasn't any good.
Yeah,
that's a possibility.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, he's pretty straightforward.
But, you know, also at that time, everybody wanted Gibson to do good. I mean,
right.
All the local players. Curtis McPeak was in town. He would bring his banjos down for us to see. Sonny, anybody we asked to bring their banjo down so we could look at the finish or get the color right, Don Wayne Reno, they would be more than happy to be part of Gibson coming back. So I kind of look at it as not really my success, but it was the bluegrass community's success to make Gibson come back, if that makes sense to
it
you.
It does, and you're right. And if you just tune in, I'm talking to Greg Rich. We're going to get around to his induction into the American Banjo Museum in a minute. But Greg is an important luthier. Which is a hard word to spell. It's even a harder word to get past spell correct because even though you spell it right, it doesn't recognize it.
Oh, I always re-correct it.
Yeah, you have to. You have to. So what Greg is, and you're right, I think at that point, everybody would have loved for Gibson to reascend to the levels, if it were possible, to reascend to that. And what you're saying is that the players would come by and show you the ones that were, I guess in their eyes or in a lot of eyes, maybe their holy grail. Somebody else had one. I know Sonny's banjo well, and that's his holy grail. So you had the opportunity to look at those and refine, I guess, what you were doing with the Gibson line at that time.
Well, I think we, at that time, we used the best parts we could get at the time, you know, for the banjo. You know, Dick Kulish made our tone rings for us. We had the original die that cast the original flanges, doing our flanges. And we tried to build them as close as we could, given current construction and material.
And material. And
availability.
We could talk forever about materials because there's this mystery of what was in the tone ring back in those pre-war, and people have tried 1,000 different ways to recreate it.
If you want to talk tone ring, I have the answer for that.
Okay. Well, all right. But I didn't want to get too diverted. But as you mentioned, materials and matching the wood and the theories that work. Tell me about the tone ring.
Okay, let's talk about that flathead tone ring sound. Okay. I have a good friend of mine who has since passed away who worked at McDonnell Douglas Aircraft in Long Beach, California. And one day, Randy Snoddy, a friend of mine, who we've talked about before,
right,
got in an original RB3 flathead that belonged to Hank Williams Jr. And I was taking it apart one day to look at everything, and I said, Randy, would you mind if I ran this tone ring up to Ed and had him analyze it on one of those machines that do all that stuff. And he goes, he ain't going to touch it, is he? That's a killer tone ring. Don't hurt that one. You know, and I said, no, I just want to, you know, take it up there. So I took it up there, and Ed put it on the machine, and he goes, now, Greg, this machine is going to analyze the metal content in there. But I got to tell you, it's going to be false. And he said, why? Yeah, well, why? He goes, because this banjo has plating on it. It has nickel. It has copper underneath and then nickel. So it's going to read those alloys, too, as well. So
would it give you percentages?
Yeah, he did. Oh, okay. He goes, but those percentages are kind of false. He goes, like copper has the lead and stuff. And I said, you're going to be higher. He goes, so what you really need to do is to have a sample of the actual metal from the tone ring to do it right. And I said, well, I would, but I'd be dead, you know, if I, you know, can't do this with this tone ring. So he gave me the percentages, and those percentages I checked with Doug Hutchins and Jim Burlisle at the time, who were, you know, pretty well known in the industry. And that is the formula that I gave to Richard Kulish, and that is the formula that we put in the tone rings on those, you know, banjos we built back then. So was it close? I think it was as close as it could be.
That's a funny, you know, when you talk about it, and Greg, you know it because you've lived through it, but when you talk about recreating not just the style but also the materials that were used in the pre-war, which now you got to say which war, but they mean pre-World War II, because every banjo is a pre-war, because sooner or later,
we're
back in war again. But I mean, they mean pre-World War II, but the legends about where the metal came from and what was composed, and everybody has, there have been some, I know that someone has actually done a more, I know someone's cut one to examine it closer, but I don't know how that gets any better.
Well, we can go into that, too.
Okay.
So now I'm at Gibson, and I'm restoring some banjos for the Samura Corporation, you know, and he would like to find a flathead walnut 4, and Greg, I want you to upgrade this to a Florentine for me, you know, walnut 4, whatever, a Florentine model, higher-end model, which means I had to actually strip the metals off. And one thing I realized that about these pre-war rings is when you strip the plating off of them and look at them, they're really beautiful yellow brass. You know, I mean, they're just, you know, they're not a bronze color or copper color. They're just yellow brass is what they are. And when you go to engrave them, they're super soft. I mean, they engrave so easily. And I always kept that in the back of my mind. I never really thought about that. I said, you know, that's just the way those were poured. I didn't really give much thought into that until way later. But so now it's about how to get the real formula. When Earl brought his banjo into me, after the Granada came out, Earl wanted me to redo his model, because he had that Earl Scruggs model out, the yellow maple one.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was kind of hard getting to know them, but, you know, I redid the Earl Scruggs model, and it sold like crazy. I mean, it was always 150, 200 banjos on back order.
Wow.
And, yeah, I mean, all the models were. I mean, I would come in, like, on a Monday morning. I'd go, Nick, what have we got to build this week? And he goes, Greg, we're in trouble. We're 170 banjos behind on the RB3s. I go, holy moly, Nick.
Wow.
And he goes, how many? I said, we build five a day. Five a day, just never more, no less. Just quality comes first in these things. And but getting to the story with Earl, so Earl would, you know, bring his banjo over to my house every weekend. Greg, would you adjust this? Would you fix this? And one day I asked Earl, I said, Earl, would you mind if I went inside and took a little drilling of your brass on this tone ring and had it analyzed for, you know, the formula to be sure it was right? And he said, well, as long as it, you know, doesn't really hurt the sound of it.
Well, how can you?
So I said, well, what I'm going to do is just go in here on these 20 holes and just drill a little bit of a filing out of a couple of them until I had enough to have an actual gas burn done on the formula.
Right.
And they go, okay, Greg, go ahead. So I did it. Never said anything about it. And I sent that out to Ed Fair, and then Ed Fair sent me back the analysis. And I go, what is this? And he goes, well, this is just pretty cheap yellow brass.
Yeah.
And I said, well, tell me about it. He goes, well, this brass, this formula was a commonly used formula in the late 1920s and 30s on musical instruments. And I said, really? And he goes, that's all it is. That's it. I said, no secret formula, no this, that. He goes, very cheap, Greg. Cheapest brass you can get. I said, you son of a, that's it.
Thank you.
I was, all this pre-war formula, what the heck is going on with this, you know? So I kind of kept that to myself. I never said anything about that formula, you know, what it was, or I still have it, you know, here. Until I got to Recording King, and that formula is what we pour in the Recording King banjos.
How long is Recording King? I know I played one years and years ago at an IBMA event. But how long have you been making Recording King?
So I think I started with Recording King in 2005.
Okay, that would make sense then. That would make sense.
Yeah, in 2005. It's kind of funny because I gave that formula to Jim Berlisle after I got it, and Jim Berlisle poured that same formula in tone rings and started charging $1,500 a tone ring for it.
And the theory always was, Greg, and this is what I heard. If you tuned in, I'm talking to Greg Rich about some neat stuff in the banjo world. The theory had been probably developed after your discovery that they were just using scrap materials that were available to them. It's not like when Gibson was making the banjos, they weren't trying to make these Gibson Granadas that would be, you know, the object of ultimate desire. They were just using what was there. This is what I heard.
I mean, if you look at the progression of Gibson in the 20s, they were building actually beautiful banjos, tube and plate flanges, super nice stuff, you know. As we get into the Depression eras and stuff, in wartime stuff, Gibson starts using pot metal flanges. Everything was to cheapen the banjo. Gibson, in its heyday in the 20s, was competing against companies like Bacon & Day, Paramount, the Vega Boxes, you know, the super fancy banjos. So those fancy banjos were Gibson's answer for competition. I don't know about sound or how the players of those days judged them. But let's just face it, if it wasn't for Don Reno and Earl trading banjos way back when, you know, and playing Gibsons, well, we might all be playing Vegas today.
Let me ask you this before I forget it. When you took the Earl's banjo, when he got it back, did he notice the difference in the fact that you'd taken some shavings out?
No, you couldn't even tell it was such a small amount. Yeah. I mean, you could look in the banjo today. You would never know where I drilled it.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. I just went into the 20 holes, took a little burr, took out a little bit from this one, a little bit from that one, so I had a little pile of it. It didn't do anything.
Okay.
So,
I figured
Earl's batch was about 5.5 ounces lighter. No. Put the light profile tone ring in my banjo.
Oh, golly. Well, all right. So then Recording King, you say like 2005 you start making banjos. Recording King now, you do make very, very good, solid banjos, and you make very ornate banjos. You also have a line of guitars, I think.
Yes. Yeah. No, we have a complete. Well, so should we? Let's. You know, anyway, my career ends with Gibson, basically because I won't sell them my name. You know.
Okay. I don't mean to skip that. I just want to make sure that we get enough credit in there for Recording King, which is now existent and making good stuff. So go ahead, finish your story.
So basically, you know, as the banjo popularity grew and the banjo division, you know, became really important to Gibson, so did the art instruments that Jim Triggs and I built, along with some of the other luthiers like Phil Jones there. And the custom shop and the banjo division became so high profile that it kind of like angered the owners because we were getting credit, not him, for the, you know, for the name Gibson. And I won't go into too many, I won't go into any stories about that, but it led to a lot of really bad things happening. They asked me to sell my name to them. I said no, and so they terminated me.
Okay.
Which brought me to Rich and Taylor, which we don't have to talk about. And then I went to work for Saga and helped them redo the Gold Star banjo line,
yeah,
which eventually brought me to Recording King in 2005. So that's where we're at.
You and so it gets us kind of to the point now that now it's been announced that in 2021 – you will be inducted into the American Banjo Museum Hall of Fame, which is, anybody can look it up. It's full of all kinds of four-string players and five-string players, all styles of music, and luthiers are in there. Now you're going to be one of those, which I think is just phenomenal. That's, I called you as soon as I saw it, and that's why I said we got to talk. And I always want to talk to you anyway, but I wanted to talk to you right away about that and bring it all present.
Yeah, that's quite an honor. I was pretty surprised when Johnny Byer called me and said I'd been inducted.
Did you know they were even thinking about it?
He had told me before my name was on a list, but, you know, it never got enough votes. Probably because people go to my Facebook page and saw this. That guy dresses up in a T-Rex outfit and dances. There's no way.
We're gonna talk about that before we leave here. But the museum is in Oklahoma City still, right?
Yes. Yes.
And it's. I have not been there. I see pictures of people going through it all the time. I just think, for you, it just must be much more amazing, whereas I'd be more focused on five-string banjos because I love the style and the looks of the great four strings. But for you, it just must be like Disney World as far as all these things that are available to look at and see.
I mean, I love looking at old banjos and the artistry that goes into them. I just think back to that time period and just imagine those guys working on these beautiful works of art that are playable. Just to me, that's the most amazing thing.
And now the Recording King, what Greg does is great carving and coloring on the wood and also engraving on the metal. Go ahead.
Well, we have the regular line. I design the Recording King instruments for them. And it's along with Travis Apps, the product manager. And these are reissues of old stuff and new ideas, too. And those instruments are produced in our factory in China.
Sure.
And, of course, that's our factory. We don't build for anybody else. It's exclusively that all they do is build the stuff that we design for them. And then it's brought over here. But on the other side, we have the USA Custom Shop, which that's just something I do with a few other luthiers here in the States, Randall Wyatt, Ed Weber, Tim Davis, Richie Dotson, kind of all help out on these projects, building these super high-end custom pieces that I want to do.
They're amazing colors and all sorts of other little doodads and the inlays and everything. I guess people come to you and say, I want this, this, and this. And then you try to imagine it for them and show them what it's going to look like. And then
I just kind of create them, you know, whatever. And then I'll post it. And usually within, you know, 5 minutes, somebody says, okay, I'll take that piece.
I didn't know that. So you're just out there building. You're like building market homes. But nobody's buying them. You're just building these, which take a lot of effort. I mean, these are really, and I would ask everyone, if you don't do it now, find Greg on social media, especially Facebook, where he's always showing off as these banjos, these very custom banjos are developed. And they do. You can go to Recording King website. They make fine banjos and fine guitars. I think I have a guitar somewhere in my collection. But just great instruments. But if you want to see this fancy stuff, go on Facebook. And Greg is also an honorary mummerist.
This was going to go downhill
We have to because we have a mutual friend, Chip. Yeah. We'll just call him Chip for now so we don't...
Let's go ahead and call him out, Chip Lilly. Just go ahead and get him...
Chip's my friend, he's your friend, and he's also a profound mummer in Philadelphia. And you, I have one costume. I need more, and I'll wait for Chip to decide when it's time to. But you, you have a collection of mummer outfits, which just for the people listening, they can look it up easy.
This is so depressing to talk about.
But it's not, though, because they're so – but first of all, the mummers are a wonderful organization. They're always raising money for charity, and these people are very devoted. Oh, man, the stuff they do now, every New Year's Day they have a parade in Philadelphia. And now the competition is so stiff. They have these really complex performances and all these different little things involved. But you have a collection of mummer outfits from our friend Chip, and I think we've seen a lot of them. Probably not all of them, but for the listeners also, when you go to Facebook, not only will you see these wonderful bantus, but every once in a while, Greg likes to cut a rug wearing one of his mummer outfits.
You know, I met Chip on one of the forums, and we became friends. And he said, "Well, I'm a mummer." I said, "Well, I don't know what a mummer is. What in God's name is a mummer?" You know? And he goes, "Well, we dress up." I said, "Chip, you're a fireman. You're dressing up with sequins and feathers and dancing around." Right. He goes, "Hey, don't tell anybody, Greg. Yeah, that's what I do on the side." I said, "Oh." So he sent me a couple of photos and the costumes. I'm going, "What on earth is this all about?" You know? So I started watching the parades and stuff, and Chip goes, and I said, "Man, I want to get a couple of those costumes, you know, from you. I mean, it'd be great for Halloween and stuff, right?" So further, here they come. There, the first batch starts arriving. My wife is at the door going, "Oh, hell no, this ain't happening. You ain't bringing that stuff in the house." I go, honey, it's our stuff. We're married. Just don't worry about it. This is not my stuff. Our stuff, honey. She goes, "I am wearing that stuff." And I said, "Well, maybe." She hasn't worn one yet.
This is for all of us. We all own these. This is all of ours. Think of these.
We're married, honey. These costumes are now ours. But, you know, every year they compete, and then when they're done, you know, they get rid of the costumes.
Yeah,
and
right.
So, you know, great, we're sending about 20 costumes to you. Yeah, no problem. I'll take them. And it turns out, you know, because I go to some dance classes and stuff. I don't want to get into that. That's real. But I would take the costumes down there on certain – like they'd have carnival dance night or
that's perfect.
I would bring the costumes in, and everybody started dressing up in them, dancing in them and stuff. And, I mean, so I'm thinking, oh, this is kind of good. I'm going to need more costumes, you know. But it's great. I mean, you know, certain times a year you put them on or – just on a good Saturday when you feel like dressing up and walking around the neighborhood, you know. I mean, you put on a mummer costume. And, of course, I make my friends, when they come over, get in one, you know. I mean, if you're coming to my house to ask me about bantos, you're going to get dressed in a mummer's costume, and I'm going to photograph it.
So, I think that's great. I have the one. I told you Chip sent me one several years.
Yeah.
Unannounced. He calls me and says, "You have something at your front door." And I thought, how does he know from Philadelphia? I live in Kentucky. And I went on this huge – and they weigh a ton.
Right.
They weigh a ton. So I get this thing out, and it was Christmas Eve. I remember the day, Christmas Eve, and the first thing I wanted to do, this is no lie, was go outside. And I told you this off the air, but my wife's like, "You're going to go out?" And you're like, "Yeah, I'm going to go out, and I'm going to get the garbage cans." Our daughter came out and filmed it all, and I thought, "Yeah, man, I'm wearing my mummer costume."
I remember seeing that video. You were in a tiger mummer
suit. I was a tiger.
And at the time, I didn't have one. I'm thinking, what a fool. Look at this guy out there. Three months later, I'm dressed up in one.
You got a storage room full of them now.
I had to finally get a storage unit. Yeah. You know, it's packed, you know. But, you know, I'll take friends over. What do you want to wear today? Skeletons. I got panda bears, you know. And I mean, it's crazy, some of this stuff.
And you can't say enough good things about the mummers and their organizations and the charity work that they do. These people are very devoted. Chip is, like you said, a fireman. He also has he runs a business, they're so into this. And New Year's Day, Chip, I know Chip does the same thing to you that he does to me. He sends you a link where you can go watch the parade because their big parade is New Year's Day, not New Year's Eve, but it's New Year's Day.
Mummer's Day Parade.
Yep.
I mean, if you've never seen it.
Oh, it's amazing.
And you try, and my friends ask me about the costumes. Greg, no, these are mummer costumes. What's a mummer?
Yeah.
I'll send you a link, and then they watch it. Go, what in the hell was that all about? I'm not going to try to explain it. Those are mummers.
And they do it if it's below zero. They blew it. I don't know how they can stand it. I mean, they have to touch the strings at some point. And there's saxophones and a lot of string instruments. And I thought, why not?
Never mind just the music. What about the sets they build to go with it's crazy. It's just crazy.
It's like Andrew Lloyd Wright now is going on the Mummer Parade and building all these floats.
Yeah. No, Chip's. I wish I never met him, but yes.
I'm sure he's proud to hear that.
My wife actually went back to Philadelphia to see him, and he took me to the Mummers Museum and took us out for, the ridiculously bad, one of those steak sandwiches. Yeah, this is the worst crap I've ever eaten, It's canned cheese on it. I go, really? This is famous here? And he goes, yeah, that was Philadelphia steak sandwich. That's awful.
Come here. I'll show you steak. Let's go someplace else. I'll show you what a real steak is.
I could get a butter. But he goes, okay, I'm going to find you. And we went to the real famous, Pat, and then there's the competition, Geno's, They face each other, in Philadelphia. This is a Geno's Philadelphia steak sandwich. I said, well, you know what? This is a trash stand. And I just throw it. So.
Well, Greg, I'm so glad to congratulations again. And you do great work on instruments and recording.
Thank you.
And I sincerely congratulate you for being announced as having been inducted into the American Banjo Museum Hall of Fame. That's big doings. And I'm proud as heck of you for doing it. From the way you've described your beginning to where you are now, you're in the tall weeds, as my dad used to say. You're going to be in the tall weeds out there. I think you should go to the induction dressed normally, but there has to be a break where you can come out in a mummer's outfit.
Chip has already called me about getting a mummer suit for the. But I'm afraid I could be taken out just as easily. Wait, we're voting out our first inductee.
We do have standards here.
Well, I told Johnny, I said, if you're, you must have pretty low standards if I'm going in. He goes, oh, Greg, don't do it.
Well, listen, man, I'm very proud of you. Thanks so much for being available. First thing I had to do when I saw your post is I needed to talk to Greg Rich about all the banjos that he's made and this great achievement and some of the fun stuff, too, which I greatly enjoy that you're involved in.
Thank you.
Well, listen, anything else you want to say? We're coming toward the end of the year. Hopefully 2020 we'll be able to drive a stake in the heart of this year, and next year we'll be able to get around and move around. The festivals will open, and booths will open with Recording King instruments being sold at festivals. We hope so.
Yes. Well, let's hope we get through this year. It'll be that. I just can't wait to see my friends again and go to festivals.
Right. Hey, listen, Greg, I appreciate it so much, man. I took up a lot of your time, but I appreciate the conversation as always. All right?
No problem. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.